Today we're going to talk about the derivative. So let f be a function with domain in open interval I. If x is an I, then the quantity f of t minus f of x divided by t minus x measures the slope of the chord of the graph of f that connects the point x, f of x with the point t, f of t. Look at the first figure. If we let t go to tend to x, then the limit of the quantity represented by this Newton quotient should represent the slope of the graph at the point x. These considerations motivate the definition of derivative. Definition. If f is a function with domain in open interval I, and if x is an I, then the limit, as t goes to x, of ft minus fx over t minus x when it exists is called the derivative of f at x. Look at the second figure. If the derivative of f at x exists, then we say that f is differentiable at x. If f is differentiable at every x and I, then we say that f is differentiable on I. There are many different notations for the derivative. F prime is a very common one. ddx of f is Leibniz's notation, also written df over dx. And f dot was Newton's notation. There's a written figure. And the second figure, we begin our discussion of the derivative by proving some basic properties and also relating the derivative to continuity. So lemma, if f is differentiable at a point x, then f is continuous at x. In particular, the limit as t goes to x of f of t equals f of x. Of course, that's the definition of continuous. So we'll use one of our basic theorems about limits. The limit as t goes to x of the quantity f of t minus f of x equals the limit as t goes to x. Multiply and divide by t minus x. Use the fact that the limit of a product is the product of the limits. The limit on the right is just the derivative f prime. The limit on the left tends to 0, and so you end up with 0. And so we see that the limit of ft minus fx as t goes to x is 0, therefore the limit as t goes to x of f of t equals f at x, and that's the result. Example, all differentiable functions are continuous. That's what we just proved. Differentiability is a stronger property than continuity. The function f at x equals absolute x is continuous at every x, but is not differentiable at 0. And you can see that pictorially because the slope on the left of 0 is negative 1 and the slope to the right of 0 is plus 1. But let's do this analytically just for practice. Well, actually, we'll do it in a few minutes. First, we're going to have a theorem about basic arithmetic operations and the derivative. Assume that f and g are functions with domain in open interval I and that f and g are differentiable at x, then f plus minus g, f times g, and f divided by g are all differentiable at x. And for f divided by g, of course, we assume that g of x is not 0. Moreover, f plus minus g all prime at x is f prime at x plus or minus g prime at x. F times g prime at x is f prime times g plus f times g prime. And f divided by g prime is equal to g f prime minus f g prime over g squared. The proof of A is easy, and we'll leave it as an exercise. For B, we write the limit as t goes to x of f times g of t minus f times g at x divided by t minus x equals, what we're going to do is add and subtract a term, f at x times g at t. So we end up with the limit as t goes to x of ft minus fx quantity times g of t divided by t minus x plus gt minus gx quantity times fx divided by t minus x. Break that up into the sum of two different limits because the limit of a sum is the sum of the limits. And then we break up each term into a product because the limit of a product is the product of limits. So we end up with the limit of ft minus fx over t minus x times the limit of g of t plus the limit of gt minus gx over t minus x times the limit of f of x. So the first limit, of course, is the derivative of f at x. The third limit is the derivative of g at x. And the other two limits are trivial, so we end up with f prime x plus g times at g plus g prime x times f, and that's what we want. That's the product rule. To prove C, write the limit as t goes to x of f divided by g at t minus f divided by g at x divided by t minus x equals, and again, we're going to add and subtract a useful term here. Well, actually, we're going to factor out 1 over gt times gx, and then we're going to add and subtract a useful term. So we end up with the limit 1 over gt gx, ft minus xx, fx over t minus x times gx minus gt minus gx over t minus x times fx. And now we'll just use our standard limit theorems to break this up into limits we can handle. The limit of 1 over gt times gx is 1 over gx quantity squared. The limit of ft minus fx over t minus x is f prime at x. The limit of gt minus gx over t minus x is g prime at x. And that gives us the quotient rule. Example, if fx equals just x, then it's easy to see that the limit as t goes to x of t minus x over t minus x is 1, so 1 is the derivative of x. Any constant function is differentiable, and the derivative is 0. And therefore, since we can take products and sums and know what the derivative is, any polynomial is differentiable. Not a big surprise. You've known that for years. On the other hand, the continuous function f at x equals absolute x is not differentiable at the point 0, and we can see that analytically, because the limit at 0 from the left, as t goes to 0, of absolute t minus absolute 0 over t minus x is the limit as t goes to 0 from the left of minus t minus 0 over t minus 0. Because the absolute value of a negative number is minus that number, and that limit is minus 1. On the other hand, the limit as t goes to 0 from the right of absolute t minus absolute 0 divided by t minus x is t minus 0 over t minus 0, because the absolute value of a number to the right of 0 is that just that number, and that limit is 1. So just as I predicted a few moments ago, the absolute value function has slope minus 1 to the left of 0 and slope plus 1 to the right of 0, and those don't agree, so the derivative does not exist. Since the subject of differential calculus is concerned with learning to use derivatives, it concentrates on functions which are differentiable. One gets the impression that most functions are differentiable except at a few isolated points, as is the case with the function absolute x. This is what mathematicians of the 19th century believed. So it came as quite a surprise when Karl Weierstrass produced a continuous function that is not differentiable at any point. In a sense that could be made precise, most continuous functions are of this nature. In fact, using Baer's category theory, one can prove a theorem that says that most continuous functions are not differentiable at any point. That's a little too sophisticated for us, so we're going to concentrate just on Weierstrass's example. So here's B.L. van der Weerden's version of Weierstrass's theorem. Define a function psi with domain R by the rule psi x equals x minus n if n is less than or equal to x less than n plus 1, and n plus 1 minus x if x is bigger than or equal to n less than n plus 1. Oh, I'm sorry. The first part is when n is even, and the second part is when n is odd. So this function looks like an upside-down absolute x function, but moved over to the interval nn plus 1. And so this defines a function on the entire real line that zigs and zags up and down. Now we define a function f at x equals the summation from j equals 1 to infinity of 3 quarters to the j times psi of 4 to the j times x. This function, we claim, is continuous at every real x and differentiable at no real x. So that's a uniformly continuous, nowhere differentiable function. Really very surprising. This is a picture of psi. And it gives you a very good idea. So you should consider in this picture that it's extended by periodicity to the left and extended by periodicity to the right. So it zigs and zags up and down. So proof. So this is going to be kind of a long proof, but it's a sensible proof, and if you study it carefully, you'll understand it. So since we have not yet discussed series of functions, we take a moment to understand the definition of x, of f. Fix a real x. Notice that psi x is between 0 and 1 for every x. So the series becomes a series of numbers, and the jth subend does not exceed 3 quarters to the j, an absolute value. So the series converges absolutely, and therefore it converges. So it is clear that the displayed formula defines a function of x. Step one, we prove that f is continuous. To see that f is continuous, pick an epsilon bigger than 0, choose capital N so large that the summation from n plus 1 to infinity of 3 quarters to the j is less than epsilon over 4. And we can, of course, do this because the series summation 3 quarters to the j converges, so the tails are arbitrarily small. Now fix x. Observe that since psi is continuous and the graph of psi is composed of segments of slope 1, we have psi s minus psi t is less than or equal to s minus t for all s and t. Moreover, psi s minus psi t in absolute value is less than or equal to 1 for all s and t. For j equals 1 through capital N, pick delta j bigger than 0 so that when t minus x is less than delta j, then psi of 4 to the j t minus psi of 4 to the j x is less than an absolute value is less than epsilon over 8. Let delta be the minimum of delta 1 through delta capital N. Of course, you've seen this trick many times before, and you'll see it many times again. Now, we're going to do a very standard device here in analysis, which is to take the infinite series that defines f and break it up into the sum from j equals 1 to capital N, and then the sum from j equals capital N plus 1 to infinity. And we will estimate each of these two series in different ways. So we have absolute ft minus f at x is absolute value, sum j equals 1 to capital N, 3 quarters to the j times the quantity psi of 4 to the jt minus psi of 4 to the jx plus the summation of n plus 1 to infinity of the same quantity. And this is less than or equal to, put the absolute value signs inside now, so that you have absolute value psi of 4 to the jt minus psi of 4 to the jx in both series. And we know that the second series, we can just bound the psi terms by 1, because we've already noticed that. And the first series, we can bound by the terms by 3 quarters to the j times epsilon over 8, because that's how we chose delta. So the first sum is less than epsilon over 2, just because the summation from j equals 1 to infinity of 3 quarters to the j is less than 4. And the second sum is less than epsilon over 2 by the choice of capital N. So altogether, absolute ft minus fx is less than epsilon whenever t minus x is less than delta. So we've proved that f is continuous, and in fact, we've proved that f is uniformly continuous. Okay. Step 2, f is nowhere differentiable. So this is a little tricky, but we can do it. Fix x for l equals 1, 2, and so on. Define t sub l to be x plus or minus 4 to the minus l over 2. We will say whether the sign is plus or minus in just a moment. This will depend on the position of x relative to the integers. Then, absolute value ft l minus fx over tl minus x equals absolute value 1 over tl minus x, and then we're going to break the series up into two parts now, the summation from j equals 1 to l, 3 quarters to the j, psi 4 to the j t l minus psi 4 to the j x, plus summation l x, j equal l plus 1 to infinity of the same terms. Notice that when j is bigger than or equal to l plus 1, so we're in the second series, then 4 to the j t l and 4 to the j x differ by an even integer. Since psi has period 2, we find that each of the sumands in the second sum is 0. Because you repeat every if you're standing at a point x and you move 2 units to the right, the function takes the same value. Next, we turn to the first sum. We choose the sign, plus or minus, in the definition of TL so that there is no integer lying between 4 to the L TL and 4 to the L X. We can do this because the two numbers differ by 1/2. But then the Lth subend has magnitude 3 quarters to the L times 4 L TL minus 4 L X, which is 3 to the L times TL minus X in absolute value. On the other hand, the first L minus 1 subends add up to not more than summation J equal 1 to L minus 1 of 3 quarters to the J times absolute value 4 to the J T L minus 4 to the J X, which is summation J equals 1 to L minus 1, 3 to the J, as we've already noted, times 4 to the minus L over 2. And that's less than or equal to, we could sum up the geometric series there to get 3 to the L minus 1 over 3 minus 1 times 4 to the minus L over 2. And that's certainly less than or equal to, the downstairs is just 2, so it's certainly less than or equal to 3 to the L times 4 to the minus L minus 1. It follows that absolute value ft minus ftl minus fx over tl minus x equals 1 over absolute value tl minus x times summation j equals 1 to L 3 quarters to the j psi of 4 to the j tl minus psi of 4 to the j x. Which, and now we're going to break this up into two pieces, 1 over absolute value TL minus X times absolute value summation J equals 1 to L minus 1. So formerly we had the summation J equals 1 to L. Now we're going to have the summation from j equals 1 to l minus 1 of 3 quarters to the j psi to the psi of 4 to the j t l minus psi of 4 to the j x plus 3 plus the lth term, which is 3 quarters to the l times psi of 4 to the l t l minus psi of 4 to the l x. And now we're going to use the triangle inequality in its reversed order that we've seen before. Namely, we'll have the second term, the lth term, in absolute value minus the first l minus 1 terms in absolute value, and it's greater than or equal to. Okay, so this is logically equivalent to the original triangle inequalities just obtained by rearranging the terms. And the first term is bigger than or equal to 3 to the l, as we know, and the second term is less than or equal to 1 over 4 to the minus l over 2 times 3 to the l times 4 to the minus l minus 1. And altogether, just by a little algebra, this is bigger than or equal to 3 to the l minus 1. So what we've shown is that the Newton quotients, as tl tends to x, blow up as l goes to infinity. So the limit as t goes to x of f of t minus f of x over t minus x cannot exist, because when the t's take the value t to the l and the tl's, of course, tend to x, the quotient blows up. Therefore, f is not differentiable at x. The proof of this last theorem was long, but the idea is simple. The function f is built by piling oscillations on top of oscillations. When the lth oscillation is added, it is made very small in size so that it does not cancel the previous oscillations, but it is made very steep, so it will cause the derivative to become large. The practical meaning of Weierstrass's example is that we should realize that differentiability is a very strong and special property. Most continuous functions are not differentiable at any point. We've already said that. When we are proving theorems about continuous functions, we should not think of continuous functions as sort of differentiable, because they're not. Now we're going to have a look at the chain rule. Let g be a differentiable function on an open interval I, let f be a differentiable function on an open interval that contains the range of g, then f composed with g is differentiable on the interval I, and f composed with g derivative is equal to f prime of g times g prime. That's the chain rule that you learned in calculus. And now we're going to give a rigorous proof. So we're going to use the notation delta t to stand for an increment in the variable t. Let us use the symbol script capital V of r to stand for any expression which tends to zero as delta r tends to zero. And you'll see this is a notation that's due to Edmund Landau. It's very useful. Fix x in the interval I, the domain of g. Set r equal g of x. By hypothesis, the limit is delta r goes to zero of f of r plus delta r minus f of r over delta r equal f prime of r. That's just the Newton quotient. Or fr plus delta r minus fr over delta r minus f prime r equals capital script V of r. Okay, so that's on the right, that's an expression that vanishes as delta r tends to zero. And clearing the denominator, we can write this as f and r plus delta r equal fr plus delta r times f prime r plus delta r times capital script V of r. Notice that this equation is valid even when delta r is zero, which is handy because, you see, in the Newton quotient, it doesn't make any sense when delta r is zero because delta r is the denominator. But writing it this way, it's even true when delta r is zero. Since delta r can be any small quantity, we set delta r equal to delta x times g prime x plus capital script V of x. Substituting this expression into the equation and using the fact that r equals g of x gives us this equation. F of the quantity gx plus delta x times g prime x plus capital script V of x equals fr plus delta x times g prime x plus vx times f prime r plus delta x times g prime x plus capital script V of x times all times capital script V of r. And this is equal to f of g of x plus delta x times f prime gx times g prime x plus delta x times capital script V of x. Just as we derived above, we may also obtain g of x plus delta x equals g of x plus delta x times g prime x plus delta x capital script Vx. That's just like the equation we had for f. And it just says that g is differentiable at x. This equals gx plus delta x times the quantity g prime x plus capital script v of x. We may substitute this last equality into the left side of our last calculation to get f of the quantity g of x plus delta x equals f of g of x plus delta x times f prime g of x times g prime x plus delta x times capital script v of x. With a little algebra, we can rewrite this as f of g of x plus delta x minus f gx over delta x minus f prime gx times g prime x equals capital script vx. But remember, capital script vx vanishes as delta x tends to zero, so this equation we just looked at says exactly that the limit as delta x goes to zero of f composed with g of x plus delta x minus f composed with g of x over delta x equals f prime gx times g prime x. That is to say, the derivative of f composed with g at x equals f prime gx times g prime. That's the chain rule. Example, the derivative of sine of x cubed minus x squared is cosine of x cubed minus x squared times 3x squared minus 2x. So that's the derivative sine applied to the argument times the derivative of the argument, and that's how we use the chain rule. That's the end of today's lesson. Thank you.